Is this the Oregon Trail? No, it's Baseball Barbacast, but we're still going out west.
Let's hope we can avoid the dysentery on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, where we talk about the D-backs, the Astros, the Padres, and whether pitchers should have to stay in for all 9 innings. No, just 6 innings. We'll get to it. And of course, the good, the bad, the ugly on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows that Ed Walsh was the original Hacktua girl. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Good morning, Jordan. Maybe he should have thrown out the first pitch at the Mets game.
I would have supported that. All I'm going to say is that the Mets got what they deserved yesterday. they learned the hard way that the A's bang, and that if you invite non-celebrities to throw out your first pitch, you deserve to lose. That's how I feel.
It worked last time. They invited Grimace, who I would argue before this Mets run was not exactly what you would call an A-list celebrity. Mm-hmm. But enough about first pitches. The Mets drop a series at home to the A's, who don't just bang, they rip. I was around them a little bit on Tuesday, and just they're just a bad team having a totally solid time. No notes. White Sox, however, they should take some. On today's episode, we are, though, going to put on our West Coast bias hats, and we're going to journey across the country and spend some time in the Western divisions, in the American League West, in the National League West. Those are the only two ones. Very apropos, that yesterday I flew out west. I am in Seattle, Washington for a wedding. Not mine. That'd be hilarious. Shotgun wedding in Seattle. Sorry, Jordan. Not invited.
Oh, man. I was so ready 3 weeks from now. I'm so excited. And suddenly you just kind of just go a little early there. All right. That's too bad.
Actually, Tyler Saucedo is going to send my ketubha.
I doubt he will be able to sign his name in Hebrew. I could be wrong. I do like T-Sauce, but prove me wrong.
Yeah.
Tyler Saucedo.
This all goes to say that my bona fides to talk about the West are valid because I'm sitting in the Pacific time zone. But we're not going to begin in the American League West, even though we're true Patriot Americans. Well, let's begin in the National League because things are interesting. And let's just cut to the chase. Dodgers are 2 games up on August 16th over both the Padres and the Diamondbacks, who have been two of the hottest clubs in the world, any sport, over the last couple of months. Jordan Schusterman, would you like to begin with the Dads or the Snakes?
I want to begin with the Snakes. The reason why we are starting our show today with these three teams is we are going to get to the Astros. Is these have been the three best teams over the last 10 games, 20 games, 30 games. And in the case of the Diamondbacks, since June 1st, the Arizona Diamondbacks have the best record in baseball. I know we'll get to the Astros there. They hold that distinction going back even further. But Arizona has won 24 of their last 30 games, which is an astonishing mark. They have won 9 of their last 10, 17 of their last 20, 24 of their last 30. And I wrote about them today, just kind of digging into how does this team that we obviously were introduced to in a very real way on the national stage last year, they have shed their underdog label as far as I am concerned. They are too good at too many things at this point to make me think that they are going to be sneaking up on anyone. And to that point, that's another thing that is interesting when I was writing about them is not just looking at how they've been so good, but also, you know, contrasting to the path that they charted last year, right? Because understandably, what happened in October somewhat clouded our memory of that team. But, you know, we say it, oh yeah, they snuck in, they got in, but they barely hung on, right? The D-backs were awesome in the earlier part of last season. In fact, they were in first place at the beginning of July last year. That was the last time they were 16 games above 500 the way that they are right now. They were 3 games up on the Dodgers at the beginning of July last year. And it was a catastrophic July and August to the point where they were hanging on for dear life and managed to sneak in at the end, and we know what happened next. But that is what is interesting to me is there's a lot of the same pieces in place right there. They brought back a lot of guys, but I am also super interested in the fact that the pitching that they've invested in to bring in as new faces has been borderline catastrophic, while the offense has been every bit as good as you possibly could have hoped, right? On offense, we're talking about Jock Peterson being the best, one of the best DHs in baseball. Sure, he's been platoon, but he's got a top 10 WRC plus in baseball, minimum 300 plate appearances. Eugenio Suarez is not the same guy that he used to be, but still a massive upgrade over what they had at third base last year. Josh Bell has been awesome since they traded for him. That's obviously been good for Christian with Christian Walker out. And then Ketel Marte is a legitimate MVP candidate. So a lot going around on offense. They're leading the league in runs scored per game. They're top five in WRC plus. They're running the bases not as recklessly as they were before, but very efficiently. They're stealing bases efficiently. They're taking the extra base, and their defense is awesome. And all of that has amassed a pitching staff which has been better recently, but was downright terrible for like 2-3 months. And that is what is really most amazing about how many wins they've been able to stack recently.
You know, when you're a kid and your parents call you cute, and then you reach a certain age where that becomes an insult and you want to be referred to as handsome or pretty, right? Like, mom, I'm a adult. Like, I'm not cute anymore. Like, mom, I'm a real boy. I'm a you know, I think that's where I'm at with the Diamondbacks. They're not, I don't want to pinch their cheeks anymore, right? I want to put them in a suit and tie and give them the respect that they deserve. And just because they wear funky colors and play in a weird stadium and are younger than us as a franchise and were pretty, they won 84 games last year, right? Despite all that, this is a very, very dangerous baseball team, one that should be feared and one that has a real chance to win the division.
Yeah. And the reason why it's really picked up over the last month is because Corbin Carroll has finally started to look like himself. We mentioned that on a recent episode. But now we're looking at kind of a fully functioning offense, one that we still aren't really seeing, right? Because, and I know we say this about a lot of teams because of so many injuries. It's like, it's a whack-a-mole with like, okay, now this guy's hot up. Now he's hurt. Oh, okay. This guy's picking up. It's like, you want to see it all together at once. We've said that about the Dodgers. We've said that about the Braves. We've said that about the Phillies, whatever. You know, they've been without Christian Walker now for a few weeks. Gabriel Moreno has been out. I know Adrian Del Castillo has filled in nicely, and he's been a fun story. But we haven't actually seen the best version of this Diamondbacks offense yet, because when Christian Walker was cruising, Corbin Carroll was still figuring it out. That's what's really exciting about the best version of the D-backs team. But the number one question here, before we pivot to San Diego, is what in the world is this rotation going to look like? Because it down the stretch and in the postseason potentially, right? Because while the bullpen got a lot of attention and I was critical of them for not addressing it more coming into the year based on how hard they rode them in October last year, the bullpen actually has been really good. They have baseball's best record of one-run games. And even with the drama with Paul Sewald recently, they have other options. Justin Martinez, one of the best rookie pitchers in baseball this year. He is, he's been good at everything except for, I mean, he walks guys. But besides that, one of the most bright red baseball savant pages we have in the league this year. And he's 22 and throws 100 and throws a 90-mile-an-hour splitter and slider. He's outstanding.
Yeah, he's super good. I don't know how much I October trust that guy right now. It seems like a lot of, I mean, this stuff is absolutely outrageous and he's proven it, but rolling into October with a rookie as your most important high leverage reliever is a little bit concerning for me. The rotation though, you're right, is really interesting because last year it was Zach Gallen, it was Merrill Kelly, it was rookie Brandon Pfaadt, and it was cross your fingers and pray in game four of a playoff series. Then they went out and signed two big free agents in Jordan Montgomery and Eduardo Rodriguez, neither of whom inspire a whole lot of confidence right now. I think they've both been a little bit better recently. Rodriguez has only made a handful of starts coming off the IL, but it's certainly not as clear where last year was like, oh, Zach Gallen, that's a win. Oh, he's pitching Zach Gallen. That's going to be a win.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't been able to say that, but now Gallen's dealt with hamstring issues. Merrill Kelly missed a bunch of time. He just got back. As you mentioned, Erod's only made two starts. But Montgomery's been downright terrible, and he's been slightly better recently. But only Kyle Hendricks has a higher ERA among pitchers with 80 innings pitched than Jordan Montgomery. Okay,
and he's trying to do that.
Right. Right. Kyle Hendricks, like Jordan Montgomery, this is not what they obviously paid for. And I know they didn't give him the longer term commitment like with Erod.
You got to tell him. Just it's like golf, dude. You're trying to go low.
It's as simple as this. If the postseason started tomorrow, is he even on the roster?
Yeah, he's on the roster.
Now that Merrill Kelly's back and now that Erod's back, like, I think he is. But, like, I mean, he's obviously not been one of their best pitchers. Ryan Nelson has actually been sneaky very good recently. And Fott is leading their team in innings by like 30 innings, and that was not the plan, right? You were hoping Brandon Fott could be a good mid-rotation starter, which he has been, but he shouldn't be leading your team in innings. And so that is why there are so many questions that need to be answered by this pitching staff down the stretch. But the offense is going to give them a pretty big margin for error here. Now, we're going to get into some of the schedule stuff, and that's related to as we talk about the Padres and the Dodgers here. They do have a tougher schedule than those two over the final 6 weeks. But I am definitely more of a believer in this team and excited to see how much better they can get once they really are fully healthy, both on the mound and in the lineup.
You know, my Aunt Susan has always been horrified of snakes. And when I was younger, we used to send like plastic snakes in the mail to her. Like we would put a little plastic snake in an envelope and then she would like open the envelope and it would like jump out and she would be scared and we would all laugh. And I've kind of reached a point where I understand why she was afraid of the snakes all along. Although something that Aunt Susan's not afraid of is my dad. And maybe we should talk about the Padres.
Yes, and that is a good transition to the Padres of San Diego, who, sorry, Padres. I think Russ wrote about the Padres this week. So we got all three of these teams covered over on the website. So but on this podcast, you'll get words online from Jake and Jordan for the Astros and Diamondbacks. But the Padres have been right there. They have the same record as Arizona. They are like Arizona now, four and a half games up, tied for that top NL wildcard spot. And they too are chasing the Dodgers. And the Diamondback strength certainly complicates things because we have already thought about the Padres in relation to the Dodgers a lot over the last few years, but they have also been extremely impressive. And I would say that I think coming into the year, I was more optimistic about the Padres than the Diamondbacks because I did feel like there was a lot about this team that I really liked. Now, there are certainly some questions in terms of the depth of this rotation, but offensively, they still have a lot that's certainly going right recently.
There's something very cathartic about watching the Padres be good for me. Since they became relevant and changed their uniform colors, they really haven't lived up to the outrageous expectations besides the unforgettable stretch in 2022 in October against the Dodgers. Like, I don't want to discount that, but it always feels like the gap between what the Padres are and what the Padres can be is there's something frustrating about that. Even as a neutral fan, as someone who doesn't, you know, bleed brown and gold or whatever. And I can only imagine for Padres fans, that feeling is infuriating. So to see this karmic return to equilibrium, to see the baseball gods shine down upon the Padres recently has been very nice. Getting to play the capsizing Pittsburgh Pirates six times over the last week and a half certainly helps. You and seven of our middle school friends might be able to take on the Buccos at the moment. Oh. But last year, remember, not against Paul Skeens. Last year, remember, they were really good and outrageously unlucky. Their batting average with runners in scoring position was terrible. They were like losing every one run game in sight. And this year we're getting some things with the Padres where it's like, how is this happening? David Peralta, who is filled in for Fernando Tatis Jr., has a 127 WRC plus since June 1st. Sure. if David Peralta had never played another baseball game before this year, I would have been like, yeah. Instead, he's like contributing while San Diego's best player has been out for 2.5 months. Kyle Higashioka,
yeah,
their backup catcher.
Oh man,
has 13 home runs since June 1. Outrageous, just outrageous stuff. Xander Bogaerts has been back for about a month. He's still not hitting for power, but and the BABIP is pretty high. But he's certainly been better than he was. Manny Machado's been really good. And then on the pitching side, I'm going to ask an inflammatory question. Okay. Did the Padres win the Juan Soto trade? The second one. And I guess the first one by proxy.
The second one.
What's the Padres record?
No.
What's the Padres record in Juan Soto trades? What's their record in Juan Soto trades?
No, I'm not going to declare them even a 500. No. I understand what you're sort of getting at. However, if you're referring to Michael King, who has been very awesome, and Randy Vasquez, who has been
fine,
helpful, right? Helpful. We haven't really seen Johnny Brito like at all recently. So he's not really a part of that. Yeah. But we know that they also got Drew Thorpe, who they flipped, right? So that's part of that discussion to some degree. I hear what you're saying. I would still say no. Wrong time to be talking about how trading away Juan Soto is a good thing. But obviously, the point of that was to backfill innings that they did not have and trust that their offense and their outfield could still be good without him. And that has happened. So in that sense, you know, you can't totally fault them.
Sliding doors moment. If you don't trade Juan Soto, do you go get Jurickson Profar, who has arguably, no, I'm kidding, he's not been better than Juan Soto, but he was an all-star starter just like Juan Soto. And I think that trading away Juan Soto is never a good thing, right? If you are ever in a position where you have to do that, you have failed in some other way to get to that point. That being said, with where the Padres were, it was the only move they could have made at the time based upon their restrictions with the roster and the budget. And it seems so far that they did a difficult thing well. And it has benefited this team this season. Look, would Juan Soto being on the Padres make them even better? Maybe. But based upon where they were at, I think it's done wonders for them this season.
Yeah. Last thing I would say about the Padres, I mean, we've hit on Jackson Merrill, but oh my goodness, he has just been tremendous. And then, yeah, you just mentioned, you know, just having some luck on your side. This team that lost their first, I think, 11 or 12 extra inning games last season are 7-1 in extras this year, the best record in MLB, 17-13 in one-run games. But obviously now with the bullpen they've built, they are, in theory, you know, in a good position to win those games. And Mike Schilt is doing a dang good job. So that is the Padres.
Let me ask the obvious question, and then we'll take a break. Can either of these teams chase down the Dodgers? Now, saying the words chase down doesn't really describe it because in some ways they've already chased them down. They're two games back. That's like a car chase. That's like an O.J. Simpson car chase. Like, you're right behind the guy. You know, if you've already done most of the chasing, you just got to go the last two steps.
Sure.
Let me rephrase. Can either of these teams win the division? Will either of these teams win the division? Los Angeles's division winning odds right now are at 61%. It's the lowest it's been all season. I believe that is the lowest mark this deep into the season since 2021, when the Giants, you know, inconceivably won that division that year. They have not been bad, the Dodgers. They just split a series with the Brewers. They just look a little bit more flawed, and they haven't been as scorching hot as these other two teams. So Jordan Schusterman, my dear friend, who's signing my Ketubah, how do these three teams finish the year in the division?
I think the Dodgers will hang on. I do think it's going to be close. And I think that because strength of schedule leans a little bit more in San Diego and LA's favor, maybe SOS is overrated at this time of year, but I still just look at what Arizona has ahead. And I when the margins are this thin, I think that I am still going to lead towards the Dodgers, especially since they are in theory getting healthier now. And they're also going to be back kind of more at full strength than they were as this lead kind of collapsed on them. You know, it's interesting thinking about 2021, right? Because that was the season in which they were neck and neck with the Giants the whole season, right? That was not like they had lost a lead. They were just inexplicably in this unbelievable historic division race. Whereas in this case, like, Dodgers were up by a bunch, you know, as they always have been. And that these teams have managed to close the gap where the Dodgers haven't been awful. I mean, they've had some cold stretches too. But for the most part, like, San Diego and Arizona have made up the ground on their own. And that is what is so impressive and why we're talking about them to start the show today.
When is Tatis coming back?
I don't know. That was definitely something I was curious about. And that feels like a pretty significant... pretty significant X factor. I don't believe he's like close to starting a rehab assignment. So with that in mind, okay. I imagine we're still a couple weeks away.
I'm going to go out on a little limb here. You got to pronounce that B. Okay. The San Diego Padres are going to win the National League West. And here's why I believe this. Or at least here's why I'm saying this. Do I believe it? Who knows? What has been the defining storyline of the 2024 Major League Baseball season, Jordan?
Injuries.
The Chicago White Sox suck ass, and the Padres are the only team.
That's the defining. Okay, sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Got it.
The Padres are the only team in the division who still gets to play the White Sox. They have three against the White Sox and three against the Rockies left. I think that's going to be very helpful.
I thought you were like, what's one thing that could make the White Sox season even worse? Oh, remembering that they had Fernando Tatis Jr. and then he comes back and, you know, fuels the Padres to a division title. But okay.
All right. I like the idea of Tatis coming back and getting hot against the White Sox and everyone's like, revenge game. Hilarious. Anyway, Dodgers, when I saw them earlier this year, I was just so relatively uninspired.
I know. I've seen them look so bad. Yeah.
I know. So I'm going to go Padres, Dodgers, Diamondbacks.
Okay.
All three, obviously.
I hope we get it. Yeah, at this point, they're looking awesome. And then, you know, obviously that sets up for potentially a D-backs Padres, you know, wild card series.
So let's just be right. Two of these three teams will likely play one another in the first round because they've opened up a lead over that third wild card spot, which the Braves currently hold. And those will be the 4 and 5 seeds. So the 6 seed plays the 3. That 3 seed. Chances are it's the Brewers, right? And so it, like, Braves, Brewers, and then Dodgers, Padres, or Diamondbacks, Dodgers, like, that's going to be really fun to watch. Let's take a quick break so I can blow my nose. And when we return, we'll talk about the Astros. And welcome back to Baseball Barbecast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Houston Astros looked cooked. At the end of April, on April 27th, they had a really bad record. I don't actually have what it was up in front of me, but it was really bad. You can trust me.
6-19, right?
I'm a doctor.
I think it was 6-19 at one point, which it was like, no team has ever come back to make the playoffs after being 6-19. The Astros were like, don't worry about it. We're in a pretty embarrassing version of the AL West in which we will make up this ground in a hurry and now lead the American League West by 3 games. We will talk about the Seattle Mariners later during the bad portion of Good, Bad, and Ugla. But Jake, let's keep the focus on Houston. You wrote about them today. What has been going well for them?
Well, I want to just talk about the ethos of the Astros for a second. The image that came to my mind was Evel Knievel. Okay. So the Houston Astros are standing on the edge of a large gorge or a canyon or a ravine. They have like a little ramp for their motorcycle. And the Houston Astros are pointing across this gap and they're saying, I'm going to do 7 backflips and land over this canyon. And everyone's like, no, you're not. And the Astros are like, well, we've done it for the last 7 years. So I think we're going to do it. And then they rev their engine and they zoom across the gap and they land the trick with ease. And there is a mentality that exists amongst teams with postseason aspirations every year at the beginning of the season when they struggle, really, or in the middle of the season when they struggle, where they say things like, oh, you know, this is a good ball club. Oh, time will win out. Oh, the season is long. We got a great group of guys in here. We just got to play better. Every team says that stuff. Some believe it more than others. No one believes it more than the Astros. And that is because the confidence in that room is continually reinforced by results. When you make seven consecutive American League Championship Series, in your mind, you're like, oh, well, we're just going to make an eighth. And it's not like this team wanted to get out to a horrible start in April. But I think when the rest of the world was screaming that the sky was falling, their confidence was basically where it had always been. There, I found an interview with Dana Brown on MLB Network. I think it was like May 7th. And Brian Kenny's like, you guys going to sell at the deadline? Dana Brown's like, I see no scenario in which we sell at the deadline. And everyone was like, ah, what an idiot. And yeah, here we are again. Astros 3 games up over the Mariners. Now, let me just be very clear. Yeah. The Mariners being an embarrassment helps a lot.
Oh, yeah.
This remains, and we'll get into the specifics in a second. This remains, in my opinion, the most flawed version of the Houston Astros during this run. I have a lot of questions and a lot of concerns. But still, when the dust settles in a month and a half, it certainly looks like death, taxes, and the Stros in the West.
Yeah, 7-19 was the record before they went to Mexico and beat the brakes off the Rockies, but it wasn't immediately better. Then they fell to 12-24, which is right around, I think, when that Dana Brown interview you were talking about, and that's when I was like, all right, I don't really think it's happening here. And then they've just been ridiculous. And what is so amazing is the only thing that was really going right for them early in the season was Kyle Tucker was playing like one of the best players in baseball, and it wasn't necessarily translating directly to wins. He has now been injured for a good
June 3rd,
while. Okay, so he has not really been a part of this push, you know, this, you know, chasing down Seattle, whatever. It was a 10-game lead, and they are now leading the division by 3 games. So I don't know, as you mentioned with Tatis, it seems like Tucker's a little bit closer to coming back than Tatis, but still is not exactly days away. But when you have all these guys like Yordan, like Bregman, who's been awesome recently, Altuve still amazing at age 34. The bigger thing though is, and why we're still like, all right, how are they actually gonna be able to do this, and how far can they go? Can they win a postseason series to get back to a CS is again going to be coming down to the pitching. Justin Verlander made a rehab start last night, so it seems like he'll be coming back. But I also still don't really know what to expect of him. I don't really know what he is.
Let me interject.
Yeah.
The difference is that they have to win two postseason series, because Houston is not going to finish with a better record than either the American League East champion or the American League Central champion, which is hilarious, right? Probably the Guardians,
I mean,
and the Orioles,
or
the Yankees.
Might.
They could.
They
it
might.
Is unlikely.
They might.
Take a look
Central,
at what that gap
but it
is.
It doesn't look like it. Sure.
It doesn't look like it. And at every point, like now that we have the bye structure, that's a big deal. Because I always think about this with like in football, where if you have a bye in the NFL and then you win your first playoff game, you're just in the NFC championship game. Like right away, like there's no, you know, there's like no playoffs. It's like, oh, they're 1-0 in October, in football October. Mm-hmm. And here they are trying to get to the Super Bowl. And that's kind of the ALCS run that the Astros are on. Like, obviously, it's incredibly impressive. But because I believe at every point except for 2020's weird situation, they have just won one postseason series and then they're in. Not to downplay that. This year, that might not be the case because they are not going to be, in my opinion, one of the two best teams. Now, who am I to doubt them? And then when we get to the October rotation, Justin Verlander is really important here. Not just because he's Justin Verlander. Yes, he might be a diminished version of himself. He has 37 career postseason starts. Okay.
He's going to get the ball. If he's healthy,
Do you know how many career postseason starts Hunter Brown, Yusei Kikuchi, and Ronel Blanco have combined?
I believe the answer is zero or one.
The answer is indeed zero. Yusei Kikuchi pitched in October last year out of the bullpen, super weird scenario.
Yes.
But none of those three guys have ever started postseason game. And so in the event where Verlander is not himself, I know he made a rehab start yesterday and he's looked good, and they have to roll with Framber Valdez, who rules, Blanco, Brown, and Kikuchi. I mean, I'm not the biggest believer that, like, just because you have never been there before, you can't do it. I don't think that that's always true. Heroes rise. Still, I think Verlander being some version of himself is very important to this team. Now, the last thing I want to mention before I kick it back to you is the bullpen. So remember, over the winter, they went out and gave Josh Hader a Brinks truck. And the idea there was creating a monster in the back end with Hader, Ryan Pressly, who had been the closer for a number of years, and Brian Abreu, perhaps the most underrated reliever in baseball. For the first month, that trio was awful. Okay. Since then, they've been great. Josh Hader has been Josh Hader since May 1, as has Brian Abreu. Pressly, I believe, has been a little bit less than what he'd been in previous seasons, but the bullpen has stepped up as the season has gone on.
Yeah. And, you know, on the whole, 13-19 in one run games is not what you expect from this super bullpen that you have assembled. But I think when you dig into what it's been more recently, especially with Hader, which is really who, like, Pressly is the guy he's 36, 37 now, and 35, but like, he's someone that we've started to see, even as he's still been the closer, we've seen some decline, whereas it felt like Abreu was only getting better. And so when he was struggling earlier, it's like, what's going on here? But Hader, it's like you pay him this giant contract. He has to be awesome. He has to be awesome. And he has been recently. And so that doesn't mean he isn't going to be, you know, this is true for any closer, right? It doesn't mean if he blows one giant game in October that everyone's going to say, like, this is a disaster. That's very possible. But as far as recently, he's been exactly what they could have hoped. And it was quite the investment. But as for who, you know, starts those other postseason games in that first series and that second series, Blanco has certainly proven himself. Framber has had a very strange season. Brown, very up and down. So I don't know. I think they're obviously very good. And if they do get Tucker back, this is still going to be one of the best lineups in the league. And that's Houston. This is not the team that we've been taking them seriously for quite a while. So no surprise there.
Don't be shocked. One more topic before we take a break. Something we kind of should talk about. Article in ESPN this week from friend of the show, Jesse Rogers, about the potential for a 6-inning minimum starting pitcher rule coming to MLB. The idea being that starting pitchers are no longer the center of the show that they once were, and that teams are relying more on spot starts and bullpen days, and pitchers only go 4 or 5 innings, and then they give it to relievers, and that is a less entertaining product. And Jesse's article posits, would implementing a 6-inning minimum change the dynamic there? Now, I think we all understand what the quote-unquote problem is here. The problem is that pitchers don't work deep into games, and that creates a whole set of other problems. Now, the question is, does this idea of a 6-inning minimum solve that problem? Does it create other problems that might be a bigger deal? And there's a sentence in Jesse's article that I think gets to the heart of the issue here, which is, quote, the commissioner's office wants starting pitchers to spend more time on the mound, pitching deeper into games, and less time in the operating room, undergoing surgeries on their arms. Now, I would like to spend less time at the gym and more time looking at my big muscles in the mirror. Those two things don't necessarily connect. So, Jordan, I will kick the rock to you. Do you think that instituting a 6-inning starting pitcher minimum is worth the strife?
I think that there are a lot of contingencies in here, and I encourage everyone to go read Jesse's article. There are, of course, exceptions to this. You don't just make pitchers go out there and get through 6 innings, no matter what, if they're throwing 200 pitches and whatnot. But it is interesting because, to your point, on the surface, you read it quickly and you're like, well, that's counterintuitive. Why are we forcing pitchers to go deeper into games? But the key here is it's not forcing pitchers to go deeper into games. It's forcing pitchers to stop throwing as if they aren't going to go deeper in the games. In other words, the reason a lot of people have assumed that we got here is because pitchers now, because they are not expected to go deeper into games, can essentially pitch at max effort for four or five innings, throw harder the whole time, not worry about saving energy. And if you're pitching at a max effort and not as concerned about getting through a game, or also in that, you know, impacts just the style of the game in general with more strikeouts and also probably more walks and all these things, it's all combining to create a product that where we're at now is it's harder to hit than ever. And we're seeing more pitchers pitch, but not exactly the pitchers that we want to see pitch longer into games.
It's about changing the incentive structure. It's not necessarily about having pitchers pitch longer. It's about changing the way pitchers pitch to create a more entertaining product. Right now, every hurler is incentivized to throw every pitch max effort, whether it's a fastball as hard as they can or a breaking ball, ripping and spinning it as hard as they can. That wasn't always the case, right? That's not how pitching always was. And it's fair and understandable that that's what pitching has become because of technology and developmental advancements, et cetera, et cetera. But I am of the belief that it's not the most entertaining product. And so thinking about ways to incentivize a 93 mile an hour fastball, you know, that is interesting. I don't necessarily think this is the way to do it. The strategy that I would recommend is the double hook rule. I love the double hook rule. The idea is if your starting pitcher goes five innings, you get to retain the designated hitter. If your starting pitcher does not go five innings, it could even be six innings. You lose the designated hitter for the rest of the game.
I agree. I think that is a less extreme way to that still gives teams both incentive, but also wiggle room to manage around and within this, as opposed to just being like, you got to go six. I think what's important, though, the last point I want to make about this is that what you referred to as, oh, these pitchers, all they just get to go out there and throw max effort. That doesn't mean they don't want to throw deep into games. It's just that the way that they have now been training and the way that the teams are telling them to prepare is don't worry about the sixth inning. We got a guy who no one's ever heard of that's going to come in throwing 100 with a 90 mile an hour slider. So you don't have to, don't even, it's that, that is not your problem. That doesn't mean that the starting pitchers even today don't want to pitch, you know, deep into it. It's just that that is not what they are preparing to do.
It's not optimized.
Yeah,
it's not optimal right now. It's easier as an organization to pluck some small school champion in the 19th round and send him to do a weighted ball program and have him throw a slider 80% of the time and have that person pitch the sixth. Okay, then it is to, that's better than telling, like, I'm trying to think of an example. That's like better than telling friend of the show, Carlos Rodon, to like air it out in the sixth inning or like pitch in a way that allows you to throw the sixth and the seventh. It just doesn't make sense. And so changing that structure is really going to be what shifts this. Now, I don't think this is happening anytime soon. Let's just be clear. Like this is kind of a little bit wonky and out there, and I don't think teams and players would go for it. That being said, it is certainly interesting, so kudos to Jesse for putting it out into the world.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And they're very transparent here, right? The quote from the MLB official, ESPN, we're interested in increasing the amount of action, restoring the prominence of starting pitcher, reducing the prevalence of pitching injuries. There are a whole host of options in addressing those issues. And this is one that, as we've seen with many things in the way that the league has instituted new rules, they put it out there and they see how people respond and they see how players respond and they kind of get it in the discussion. And then you figure it out from there. And so I don't think that's a bad way to go about doing this, but I think that this issue in particular is going to take a lot of creativity, a lot of patience, and a lot of collaboration for a lot of different people involved. But I also think that the thing to remember, which is always important for any rule changes that we always think about, and we always say, oh, that's so extreme, there's no way they could do this, is the sport adjusts. The players would adjust, the teams would adjust, that's the job, right? And so if baseball did decide tomorrow, you got to throw six innings, teams would figure it out. And I think that is a thing to always remember.
They said the same thing about night games. They said the same thing about night games, okay? Now they're all at night. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we will do the good, the bad, and also the ugly. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast on this beautiful, delightful Friday. It is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. Good, one thing good. Bad, one thing bad. One thing, Dan Ugla, odd, bizarre, weird, irreverent. Mr. Schusterman, what's good for you?
Couple options this week, but I'm just going to keep it simple and keep it biased. And even though I'm not the Orioles fan on this here podcast, Kevin Brown being extended as the voice of your Baltimore Orioles is very cool. And not only because we've had Kevin Brown on this podcast, but just knowing how Kevin has kind of become synonymous with the rise of this Orioles team and knowing that that will continue on in the future is really exciting. It's something that to have, you know, we've seen like turnover in the broadcasting space recently across the league. And it's jarring as someone who, for us, I mean, the Orioles mean more to us than the average team, but like, we watch everybody. And so we get used to play people in markets and on certain broadcasts. And I, not that I expected Kevin Brown to suddenly go somewhere else, but like, this is a really good decision. And it's not as important as, I love you, Kevin. It's not as important as extending Adley or Gunnar or whoever, but it's a big deal. And I think that in a similar way, it is a fan service and a true commitment to what you want Orioles baseball to be. And so I'm really excited about that for Kevin.
When you are in a competitive window, you want there to be a voice of that. Mm-hmm. It is good branding, right? There's a reason the Allstate guy, you hear that voice and you recognize it. It's just the same thing. Kevin Brown's just like the Allstate guy, okay? Mm-hmm. And for the Orioles to recognize that, I think, is really important. What's good for me? Jordan, it seems like Tristan Casas is going to play some baseball, dude, in the major leagues. Red Sox baseman Tristan Casas, whose fame has skyrocketed this year despite barely playing because he had an oblique or a rib issue that kept him out for an extended period, has been very around. He was like at the All-Star game, I think, interviewing players, and he's been on broadcasts, and he's been kind of turned into something of a meme, but he's going to play baseball. Casas is one of the more interesting characters we have in the sport. I remember when we spent draft day with him all the way back, I believe in 2018. Good cat, fascinating guy. And the Red Sox need a spark. This team has kind of been in something of a sludge over the last week and change. Now, it would be more helpful if he was a pitcher. That would be better for the Red Sox. But, and Dom Smith is raked in his absence.
Still,
Tristan Casas returning is good for everyone. What's bad for you, Mr. Schusterman?
The Mariners.
Embarrassing.
Not going to go too long on
embarrassing.
This.
Embarrassing.
I drove back from Toronto, more on that in a second, to Detroit to see the Mariners on Tuesday. Kirby Skubal, oh, this will be fun. I just went as a fan, sat in the outfield, enjoyed as a normie baseball person. They give up the most runs they had, most hits they had in, I think, 5 years. Kirby gets crushed. Defense, catastrophic, terrible. Okay. You can lose like that. It's like, well, that was embarrassing. You
Tigers
that,
are a
right?
wagon, dude. They're a wagon, Tigers.
And hey, Kerry Carpenter is legit. Okay, great. Whatever. But like, you lose that badly. Embarrassing. You flush it. You move on. Because you're like, you know what? Well, that's better than losing like a close one, right?
And that's the best thing about baseball is you get to play again tomorrow.
Right. It's like, all right, hey, that's easy. That was a fluke. Who cares? It's not like we got our heart ripped out. I mean, we lost the game in the third inning and it was over. Oh, wait, don't worry. They basically just then played the same game on Wednesday and Thursday. Like, to the degree that they had a lead late, Brian Wu, amazing. Bryce Miller, amazing. I think they combined for 14 scoreless innings. Their starting pitching gets better and better. Their offense gets worse and worse. And the bullpen blows it in embarrassing fashion. And but really, because they can't hit, right? I mean, the bullpen has generally been good. Munoz hadn't allowed a hit in 14 games and then allows a home run to Javi Baez. Just horrible. Embarrassing. One of the worst suite. They've had some low points this season, but certainly in the context of Houston continuing to win, this is a very, very bad, bad, bad time. Now they go to Pittsburgh, and then they go to LA next week for the Dodgers. So good luck. They got Paul Skeens tonight. Surely that will get the bats going.
Do you think that the hitters and the pitchers dislike each other in that room? Now, that's maybe the wrong way to ask this question. Let me rephrase that. The pitching has been so good.
Yeah.
It's been so good. And the hitting has been so bad. So bad, the hitting. And I would imagine that if I was the pitchers, there would be a sense of frustration and disdain towards the incompetent offense when it is this stark, when the difference between the two units is this stark, right? It's almost like, you know, in a municipal community where, like, you know, the fire department is freaking awesome, but like the trash service is terrible. You know, we need all people pulling their weight.
Yeah, no, it's not happening. Not happening. So, it's just really bad. And also, by the way, now it's like, right, like they're in a situation, if the Astros pull away, now it's like, okay, forget the division. You're immediately pivoting to, oh, they're not even going to make the postseason. Oh, are they not even going to finish above 500? It's slipping very quickly. Again, doesn't matter. They're going to have Logan Gilbert take them out again tonight. They have, in theory, a chance to win every night because they have the best rotation in the league. But if you can't score runs, you're not
score
winning.
Four so runs.
That's bad.
Score four runs.
Score three runs. You'll be winning most of these games.
Jordan, the Mariners are not home right now. I am in Seattle. I'll walk around and take the pulse. I'm sure people are feeling quite optimistic.
Do some journalism
up here.
Yeah.
You know what's bad?
What's bad for you? Yeah.
The Red Sox signed Rich Hill. Now, good for Rich Hill, who I think is, 78,000 years old?
Yeah. He's younger than Biden, 44. But he's close, I think.
Younger than Biden?
Yes, younger than but not Biden. By much.
Older than 44. J.D. Vance.
Yeah, I guess so. what about Rich Hill? What's bad about Rich Hill? We love Rich Hill.
We love Rich Hill, and it's great that he is raging against the dying of the light. Any 44-year-old human being who still wants to play Major League Baseball and conceivably can do that, I tip my cap to you. Rich Hill is one team short of tying the all-time record for most teams suited up for in MLB history, held by Edwin Jackson. And Rich Hill has already played for the Red Sox. So this is a waste.
This is his fourth separate stint with the Red Sox.
Waste.
Come on, man. I know you're from New England. I understand that this is a team that means a lot to you, and I understand.
You want to retire as a Red Sox?
That's all nice. I don't care. This is about me and my relationship with the Baseball Reference Most Franchises Played For page. Okay,
Rich, go to the Rockies.
Don't understand. It's not like that. I mean, I'm sure there are some other teams that could use a pitcher, although Boston. Hey, White Sox has a pitch for the White Sox. Mm. Anyway. Wrong socks, Rich. Let's go to Ugla. You go first, Jake.
Something I saw in the lobby of my hotel this morning is Ugla. Okay. So, you know, I'm sure you've had this scenario. You're traveling with your significant other and, you know, you wake up first. You go down to the lobby and get some work done because you don't want to wake them up. So I head down there, get a cup of Joe. And they got a Sports Center's on the television screen. Now, I don't watch SportsCenter regularly at home because I'm a millennial and I've cut that cord. And why would I watch a program that doesn't talk about the sport I cover? Right? Doesn't really make sense. I don't need to know how the Patriots quarterback battle is unfolding during mini camp or OTA, I think is a thing. Anyway, and I look over there on the screen, and in the corner of the screen, there is a little diamond graphic. And there is the face of a baseball player in the middle of it. And around the edge are some words. Four words. And those four words are Weston Wilson cycle watch. And I see that and I gasp. I gasp to myself that that phrase Weston Wilson's cycle watch made its way onto a SportsCenter graphic. Now, the idea of that is so funny to me because, let's just get this out of the way, Weston Wilson, Phillies bench guy, hit for the cycle yesterday at home against the Nats. Phillies' last two games have looked back. Kyle Schwarber with a cathartic grand slam against Miami, kind of reviving the energy of the Philadelphia Phillies, blah, 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 blah. So Weston Wilson does that. But the idea of putting up a Weston Wilson cycle watch graphic implies that he might not hit for the cycle, right? It's not Weston Wilson's cycle check-in or review. Yes. It's, will this happen? And like, if you had Shohei Ohtani's cycle watch or Aaron Judge's cycle watch, it's one thing. But just to have Weston Wilson's cycle watch, that is so good. I took a picture of it.
That is so funny. I do think it is also kind of epitomizes, we don't have time for to do discourse about how the big four letters covers our sport, but it does make sense because that is baseball things that make SportsCenter is just like historical achievement. Like basically no matter who you are, right? Because they're not really just talking ball anymore on SportsCenter. That's not really in the repertoire with all due to our ESPN friends that talk about baseball. So anyway.
Also, just so you know, Drake May looked pretty good in the first preseason game for the Patriots against the Eagles. I believe they scored 10 points while he was on the field. Jacoby Brissett didn't look quite as good. So I think May is going to take that cake there.
He's going to do it. All right. That's
Drake May cycle watch. Jordan, I just texted you a picture of Weston Wilson's cycle watch.
I am looking at this and I'm like, man, I wonder if he's going to get it.
He does. Spoilers.
Oh, he does. Okay. So why would I watch? Well, that's why they have to tell you because it's like.
It should say, watch Weston Wilson's cycle.
All right. My ugly will be fast because I have San Diego radio to do in 3 minutes. Jake Mintz. I was in Canada and I encountered two pieces of baseball history that were just absolutely fascinating. The first was before I went to the Avril Lavigne concert on Monday, spent some time on Center Island in Toronto, and they have a place called Hanlon's Point, which was the site of Babe Ruth's first professional home run, which is fascinating. He only had one home run in the minor leagues with the Providence Grays before he started playing with the Red Sox, and it happened in Toronto. So I thought that was cool. And then I drove to Detroit. I drove through London, Ontario, home of Labatt Park. Are you familiar with Labatt Park? So Labatt Park, we talk about Rickwood Field being the oldest, you know, operating baseball stadium in the United States, which opened in 1910. Labatt Park has been open since the 1870s, and I learned is still home to the London Majors of the Intercounty Baseball League. And I learned that the first recorded baseball game ever played a year before Abner Doubleday was claimed, and he was playing baseball in Cooperstown, was in Ontario. In Beechville, Ontario, not far from Labatt Park, which is not called Labatt Park at the time. So anyway, Canadian baseball history is fascinating. And though I didn't get to see Joey Votto in his heroic homecoming as a Blue Jay, I did get to learn a little bit about baseball in Canada.
Canadian supremacy. Good for you, Jordan. What a clap it up. Valuable history lesson.
How about that? Canada.
Oh, Canada. Here's a random admission, then we'll end the podcast. I kind of gone down a skateboarding rabbit hole recently on YouTube.
Oh, nice.
And there was this skateboarder.
Nice Houston action? Yeah.
No, this dude named Andy Anderson. So if anybody out there listening knows about Canadian skateboarder Andy Anderson and wants to talk to me about it, please do. Because I just like went all the way deep into like Vancouver skate culture.
Mm.
And so I appreciate the focus on the great white North. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Fun weekend ahead. The Williamsport game is happening on Sunday with the Yankees against the Tigers. It's the first time the Yankees have gone to that. So that'll be pretty cool to see. Aaron Judge next to a bunch of small children will be very funny because of the height difference. I'm actually more excited to see Aaron Judge next to the tall little leaguers to be like, that is the biggest child ever. Yes. I have this wedding in Seattle where hopefully no one talks about the Mariners. Jordan, Anything else you want to thank Andrew Hartz?
No. Thank you to Andrew Hartz, the producer. You can email us at baseballbarbcast@gmail.com. And yes, tonight, Logan Gilbert against Paul Skeens. The Pirates have lost 10 in a row. The Mariners just embarrassed themselves in Detroit. One of those teams has to lose that game. And believe it or not, one of them actually has to win it too. Thank you all for listening. And we will talk to you all next week.